In here? Not quite on?
Now
we have sound. Okay. Good morning, everyone. I'd like to call this regular meeting of the San Luis Obispo Planning County Planning Commission to order. With that, clerk, if you will call the roll.
Commissioner Christensen.
Here.
Commissioner Milkow.
Here.
Commissioner Wyatt.
Here.
Vice Person Wyatt.
Here.
Let the record show Commissioner Christie is absent.
That will go to the
council's office. It would be very convenient for me, since I was planning on advising on that item, if the commission would make a decision early on today whether or not to grant that continuance or not.
So is that something we could do now, discuss that action?
Yeah, I believe that you can, yes.
Okay, out of order. So is there comment from my fellow commissioners on that, or anyone want to make a motion or discuss that request for continuance?
I guess my only question would be if people show up for that hearing item at the scheduled time, would any discussion be allowed if we continue it?
No, I think the answer to that would be that the way that the agenda for the Planning Commission is prepared, it notifies everyone that all the items are actually set for 8:45 in the morning and that you can't really depend on an item coming up at any particular time. So if the commission acts on the item and continues it, that would be the end of it until the continued date.
Okay, so I'm not hearing a motion then for continuance. So that actually, the
applicant has asked for continuance to the next meeting. I'm happy to grant it. I don't really see a problem with people. I don't expect crowds of people to come down and speak to this item. So I will make a motion to continue this item to the next meeting as the applicant has requested.
Appellant has requested. I'll second that.
Madam Chair, I might suggest if there's anyone here who happens to be here now, they might want to speak to the item or to the idea of continuing the item.
Thank you. Yes.
I'm sorry, Madam Chair. I didn't hear that there was a date. Did the motion include a date to continue it to?
To the next regular commission meeting. Next possible regular one.
May I make an alternative suggestion?
Sure. Of course.
The next regular meeting is going to be all day on Los Osos Sewer.
Ah.
So I would recommend you continue it to May 14th. There is 45 minutes available.
Okay. I'd like to amend my motion to continue the hearing item number 4 to May 14th, to the May 14th meeting.
Okay. And we have a second for that. The seconder agrees. Okay. Anyone here to speak to this item? Okay. So we have a motion and a second. I'll just note timing today. It does leave us some extra time today, and we may be a little tighter on the 14th. And staff is prepared to deal with this and has recommended that we hear it today. But if my colleagues are comfortable and there's no other discussion, then we'll go with that. So do we need a roll call then, clerk, or is this a voice vote?
I think it's just a voice vote.
So all in favor of the motion to continue this item until 14 May? Aye.
Aye.
Okay, so with that, we'll continue item number 4, the setting appeal, until the 14th of May. Thank you. Okay, now we'll move on then to public comment. I have one speaker slip in, Eric Greening.
Good morning. I am Eric Greening, and several of you who are there, at least two of you who are there, took part in the lengthy Planning Commission process on devising implementations for the adopted smart growth policies, which are now called strategic growth policies. And the County Board of Supervisors continued their action on this item to next Tuesday. My understanding is they have taken public testimony, but it might still come in handy if a member of your commission were present in case there were questions about your intent or your process or anything about how you arrived at your recommendations. They are actually working off a slightly different set of recommendations. County staff did a bit of rearranging and condensing of your recommendations, and it appears to me that most of your intentions are well served by this, but it probably would not hurt for members of your commission to double check this as well. And I just wanted to make sure you knew that this was happening, so that if you wanted to be there to watch or simply be available in case things came up. Obviously, smart growth, strategic growth, whatever it is, we have to take it more and more seriously, both because of physical issues and because of the legal setting with the passage of AB 32, SB 375, and so on. We are more or less directed to frame our planning efforts in those same terms that the Board of Supervisors forced.
Just gone to them yesterday.
So that will appear under correspondence in the pink sheet?
That's correct, yes. Anyone else here for public comment? Anything not on the agenda anyone would like to speak to? Okay, with that, we'll move to planning staff updates. Mr. Hogue.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Actually, I already scooped myself. The main thing I was going to remind you is that at your next regular meeting is the Los Osos Sewer Project hearing, and that's the only item on the on the agenda with possibly maybe a minutes on consent. And so you'll have the whole day to spend on that, and we also have, as a safety valve, the next Thursday, the 30th, the board chambers is reserved. And you can continue to that date if you need to continue your deliberations, which I think is entirely possible. So I wanted to make sure that that was in your calendars and on your radar screen. And then in May, we're back to the regular two meetings a month schedule, and that stays second and fourth Thursdays. And that stays constant until we get to July. And the first meeting in July will be on July 6th, which is a Monday, because the board chambers is reserved the rest of the week for the Coastal Commission meeting. So those are the blips on the radar screen that I wanted to make sure you were aware of. In terms of other items for planning staff updates, I would just note that we will be having the annual training for the Community Advisory Councils on Friday, April 24th at the City County Library Community Room from 8:30 to 12:30, and all of the advisory council members are invited to that, and it's usually a very interesting occasion, and if any of you individual commissioners would like to attend, you're certainly welcome. So that's it for staff updates. At this point, I will turn it back to you. Thank you.
Thank you.
I've got a question. Mr. Hogue, I see the supervisors have made some decisions on this, on the Los Osos Sewer at their last meeting, as far as what type of system it'll be. Will that be included in our staff report, or how does that work?
Actually, I think the staff report had been published at the time before they made that decision, but I'm not sure that it really changes that much, and we'll certainly report that in some fashion, either by separate cover or at the meeting. But they basically made the decision to stay with a gravity system,
right,
rather than going to a step system, and that is what is in the project description of the matter before you on April 23rd. So I'm not sure that that is a stumbling block, if you will. I'm looking for the council on that project, not here. So, you know, we'll certainly report to you, but when you get your written staff report, it may not actually, what the board did Tuesday may not actually be specifically mentioned, but I believe that project description that we prepared the report for was based on a gravity system.
Okay, thank you.
Any other questions for Mr. Hope? Okay, thank you. Okay, moving on to our consent agenda. We have minutes of December 11 and minutes of January 8 and February 11.
Chair, I had a question because December 11th, only two of you were here, and the two of us don't vote on that, so I don't know if you can pass it with just two of you. And then I had made some suggestions to staff editing those minutes. So other than that, I don't have any comments.
Editing the minutes of January 8th and February 11th?
February 11th, yeah.
And are they included in the drafts that we have, the last drafts, or have you seen inclusion of those edits?
That's a good question. I don't...
And I did make those changes.
You did make those changes. Okay, then they are included.
Okay. So those were post distribution of the packet, so those have been incorporated, but we don't have copies here. So... I guess that's a little messy procedurally if the edits have been made, but we haven't seen them.
Right, that's and I don't have a record of what I said online. I mean, I could go look on my email program, but...
You want me to bring the minutes back
then? We probably should bring the minutes back to so we know what we're improving, and then I don't know how you handle the December 11th ones.
With just two of us here, maybe it would be prudent to bring them back so at least three of us are here to...
Yes.
To vote on those next time.
Okay.
So procedurally, how do we act? Do we continue these consent agenda items, or sir?
Well, they're not noticed. You can continue it or have direction to bring it back to the next meeting, or.
No,
it's not.
It's not coming out of this mic.
Yeah, I'm not getting you either.
Okay, so item one is a study session on the tax implications of the Williamson Act, and it's an assessor presentation. And the planning staff contact is Terry Waller. Did you hear that? Okay. And I'll go on to say that I'm Warren Hogue of the Department of Planning and Building, and I would like to introduce our team today, and that's Terry Waller of the Planning Department, who's our senior planner, in charge of administering the Agricultural Preserve Program, which is our name for the program that implements the Williamson Act. And we have a special guest here today, Lisa Goforth from the Assessor's Office, which we appreciate her assistance and participation. And they're going to give you a short presentation, and then we'll have some time for questions and answers. So at this point, I'll turn it over to Terry first, and then I think he'll turn it over to Lisa.
Thank you.
Make sure the mic, oh yes, it is working.
Oh, very good.
I am Terry Waller, planning staff. Good morning to you, planning commissioners.
Morning.
And today I just want to do a quick overview of the Williamson Act program for you and acquaint you with some of the basic provisions, but primarily we're going to be looking at the property tax implications. The Williamson Act is a bill passed in 1965. It is also known as the Land Conservation Act of 1965.
We're not getting your presentation on screen.
Okay.
You have something for us, Terry, on screen?
Yeah, we'll get up in a second. We're playing with reminder.
Okay. Too many technological issues at once.
Unexpected technical difficulty.
Okay.
Sorry.
Yeah.
Welcome to the modern world.
Okay, here we go. So the Williamson Act is also known as the Land Conservation Act of 1965. Which is the year in which it was passed. Its purpose is to preserve agricultural land by reducing property taxes for farmers and ranchers, primarily. It is the county's major land conservation program, protecting farmland and open space lands throughout the county. I have a map here for you to take a quick peek at it, if you can all see that. The dark green areas are under land conservation contracts. You can see they're concentrated in the eastern part of the county, but we have quite a lot of land on the western side as well, a little bit less in the 101 corridor, not surprisingly, because that's where the urban areas are. By the way, the lighter color in the center, the band in the center of the map, is public land. So we actually have quite a lot of land protected under the program and in public ownership. We have some statistics here for you, and just I'll hit the high points again. 37% of the land is covered by land conservation or farmland security zone contracts, and the average reduction is about $2,370 per parcel.
So the average reduction, 2,300, you said?
Yes, and we'll need to qualify that when we get into the property tax, because there's many different situations that occur. Although the planning department staff is the primary, or I guess you could say the lead program managers, we really work with a number of other county departments. We have a whole team of people in the assessor's office that are very helpful and cooperative and do lots of work regarding this program, implementing it. And we also have support from the Ag Commissioner's office and County Council's office. The Agriculture Preserve Review Committee reviews new applications primarily, but they also help us monitor the program. And from time to time, as you know, since we just recently did this, they review the rules of procedure and periodically recommend changes. The committee itself is made up of a diverse background of people. Primarily, we have agricultural organizations, and we also have environmental organizations represented, soil scientists, and public at-large members. The purpose of the rules of procedure is really just to help us implement the Williamson Act statute locally and integrate it with our local land use planning program. And there's many different twists and turns, but we don't have time to get into that right now, so I'll just move forward with a couple of the basics. The program is based on soils, and the soils that the data that we use is from the Natural Resource Conservation Service land capability classifications. And typically the best soils, which are usually irrigated, allow for smaller parcel sizes because they're more productive, so that kind of makes sense. And the larger properties for dryland farm and rangeland, typically we see more rangeland, an interesting concept. These preserves typically require 100 acres of land, but it is possible to join together with neighbors as co-applicants with as little as 40 acres. Just briefly going over preserve sizes, we typically will have a 40-acre prime land preserve, and then we also have the 100-acre minimum requirement for dry farm or rangeland preserves. Those are we also have mixed use, which involves dry land as well as irrigated land uses. And just briefly hitting the terms of contracts. 10-year contracts are permitted if you're within 1 mile of an urban reserve line, and 10-year terms are also required or allowed if you're abutting, that's immediately next to a village reserve line. So in those instances where you're closer to urban areas, you have a shorter term on your contract, but typically most of the contracts are 20-year terms, and they start self-renewing at 10 years. So they go from 20 down to 10, and then from there they stay put at 10 and renew every year unless you file a notice of non-renewal. I should point out that the Williamson Act contracts are an important tool in land conservation, but they are temporary, and so I think it behooves us all to look for other ways to look at more permanent land conservation programs and techniques where those are appropriate. And from there, I will turn the microphone over to Lisa from the assessor's office.
Hello, Board. Lisa Beaufort with the County Assessor's Office.
Got your mic for you.
Do I get to be in control of that?
Yeah, would you like to?
Really want to be in control of that thing.
I could switch here.
Okay. Now we'll see if I can do it. Property under contract is eligible for the lowest value, whether that be the Prop 13 value, the Williamson Act value, or the current fair market value. So you're protected that your taxes will be the lowest of the three values. The property is valued each year, and it's based upon the income from the property. The county assessor's office maintains records on prices, yields, and then we're given a cap rate from the State Board of Equalization in order to capitalize the income from the property. We use average. If you're a poor operator, you get taxed as the same as a good operator. It equalizes the taxes. But it does change each year depending on the cap rate given to us by the State Board of Equalization, the risk rate. And so It doesn't go up 2% a year like the Prop 13 base. It can fluctuate some. Also, when property comes off of exemption, trees and vines are given an exemption until they're in full production. And when property comes off that value is added on in that year, and the value can go up a lot for a property owner because their property is now fully taxable. We're guided by the State Board of Equalization and the Revenue and Taxation Code and how we value the property. So that's basically who makes sure we're doing the valuations correctly.
And so are those state amounts then state averages, or do they narrow that then to do some county by county
assessment?
So it's some local average, but decided by the state?
No, the averages for the price and production, those come from us. We send out surveys each year to find out what last year's production was and the prices for the ag products. And so we gather our information from that, and the Ag Commissioner's office we work with sometimes because they have information that we would use as well. The state numbers are the cap rate that they come down with. The numbers I've given you, the property tax reduction countywide is about $2 million, and that's just the county's portion of value. You know, we don't get every dollar that comes in, so that is the direct loss to our county. And we also receive a subvention payment, and last year that was $1,088,000, and that's based on prime, non-prime designations. Prime land, we get $5 an acre. Non-prime, we get $1 an acre in subvention funds. Terry wanted to know the implications of the state budget on subventions, and unfortunately, if I knew that, I would be the smartest person in this room. I don't know what's going to happen next year with the subventions, and I don't know anybody that can predict that. We did get, as I said, $1,088,000 last year.
So the cost to the county then was about the million difference.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
You mentioned earlier that there was 2 million acres in the Williamson Act, and you said we get $1 an acre, but we only get $1 million. We only get $1 million. If we have 2 million in there, how comes we're not getting 2 million?
Still pay on the current fair market value of that home site, and it is affected each year by the 2% indexing from Prop 13. And all their houses and structures are also on Prop 13. Farmland Security Zone valuations are 35% less than the Williamson Act valuations. And I put some examples on the board. This is definitely the cliff notes. There is a lot of information running in the background of the valuations that we do. This is cattle graze, and you can see that 238 acres of cattle graze is taxed at $15,000. And if, in this instance, in this example, the current market value of the property is probably over $1 million, but the taxable value is $15,000. And then this one had a 1979 base value of $28,000. So this property owner does not receive that much benefit from the Williamson Act, but they still receive a lower taxable value. This is dry farm. In this instance, you can see that there's a site value up there of $40,951. And I know this is really boring, but the real value on the land is $238,000. So they receive a benefit of half, but they still have to pay the Prop 13 value on the site value for the house and the house. And what happens in vineyard valuation is there is a land value, and then there is the valuation on the vines. And the land value is based upon highest and best use unirrigated, which in this case is dry farm barley, plus there's a portion of it that is appropriate for cattle. This is all based on, as Terry talked about, the land types, the soil types. So in this instance, they have a very low land value, but they still pay quite a bit on their trees and vine value. You can see they have a variety of grape types, and the more valuable grapes are valued higher for the Williamson Act. row crop valuation also is a high value crop, and in this instance, for example, the value on this property is actually $1 million for Prop 13, and their Williamson Act value is a tenth of that. But without the Williamson Act, I don't know that they could grow row crops on the land because it's so valuable.
Let's just, if we could go back to that one, because it was relatively simple. And this, these are the calculations that I haven't understood, and I'm still not quite sure. So we have number of acres, and then we've got some estimated tonnage that can be produced from this number of acres or per acre?
Right, there's all acre. Kinds of charges. You're not going to be able to figure it out. There's all this information running in the background. That's why I said this is the Cliff Notes valuation methodology, because there's cap rates, there's charges taken out for wells, for pumping costs, all those things that go in. Then you come up with a net value, and then you capitalize that by the cap rate and the risk rate and the tax rate. And that's how you then get to the $144,000. You can't... This is what we have in our files to basically show, you know, what we used, but there's all the information running in the background to create the value. And we keep charts on... Here's the information from the state. We have all the interest component or the risk cap rates here from 1975 from the State Board of Equalization. And the lower the cap rate, the higher the value of the property. There's an inverse relationship. So all things being equal, if the cap rate goes down, the property value goes up. And it's a math function. And so that's what happens.
I had a question on the minimum acreage. This example shows 28.5, and I thought in Mr. Waller's presentation, he mentioned 100 acres minimum unless you did a co-op, and it would be a 40-acre minimum.
This is probably something that has been in the Williamson Act for a really long time, and the new buyer bought it under this old contract.
So when did the minimum acreage size change, do you know?
I'm sorry, could you restate your question so I can understand it fully?
I thought in your presentation you mentioned the minimum acreage for qualification was 100 acres unless you do a co-op, and then it would be 40 acres. This example is 28.5 acres, and my question is, when did the minimum acreage requirements change?
Well, this is irrigated, an example of irrigated land, which would be under prime land. So that would be... And it's possible that this individual property is part of a situation where there's
a sample farmland security zone calculation, and you can see the P13 is the Prop 13 value of $1.2 million. The open space value gets down to $300,000, and then the farmland security zone value is 35% less than that. Also, just keep in mind that the improvements on the property, non-living improvements, which would be structures, is not given any benefit from either the open space Williamson Act calculations or the farmland security zone calculations. And that's the end of my presentation. As you can see, it's a very complex proposition each year to value these. We have our computer do the bulk of it, the bulk of the valuations now. When I first started at the assessor's office, we had one person run all these calculations every year. So we've saved a lot of time with the computer now.
And I guess back to me. Did you have questions that you wanted to ask Lisa regarding some of these calculations or concepts? Or?
I expect we do. Some questions?
Yes. You mentioned that trees and vines were given an exemption. Is that exemption the same for vines as it is for trees, or is there a difference? Or
it depends on the kind of tree. It's usually 4 to 5 years, and then sometimes we will have to put property back on exemption if they've had a killing freeze and some of the vines have died. So this is just like agriculture. It's affected by the weather, and the values of the property are affected by the weather, the droughts, freezes, wind. It's risky business.
You mentioned trees are generally 4 to 5 years. Are grapes the same?
They're four. So on the, the fifth year, they would be valued.
Okay.
And that is for trees and vines, whether they're under the Williamson Act or not, because not all of our vineyards are under Williamson Act, nor are all our trees. So they're all treated the same in that manner.
Okay. Thank you.
Other questions? I just had a question. Your outline talked about relationships between restricted value and Prop 13 value implications for intergenerational transfer. Did you actually talk about that yet?
I didn't.
Okay.
What kind of detail would you like?
Well, just give me a Cliff Notes view of the implications for intergenerational transfer. If you had it on your outline, I was thinking, maybe it was an interesting point you wanted to make, or did you decide to skip it because it was obviously going to be over our heads?
No, I don't believe that. What happens is, with Prop 13, property is reappraised as it's sold or changes ownership. So if you're not within the $1 million exemption, parent-to-child exemption in your property, then you can't leave your property to your family and not have it be reappraised. So the reappraisal, it takes many people out of the agricultural business because Dad had a value from 1975, so maybe he had $100,000 on his 2,000-acre ranch. Well, now, if I get it, I'm going to have $5 million on my 2,000-acre ranch, and I have to figure out how to make enough money off of my ranch to pay the $50,000 in property taxes that are going to be generated by the $5 million assessment. And so it would allow you to maintain a lower value on your 2,000 acres.
So that's another benefit of the Williamson Act.
Yes.
Okay.
And since it's renewed every year, I can just, and it runs with the land, I will get the same treatment.
Good. All right. Thanks.
Other questions? Side? I guess just one, and I'm... It keeps coming up, is the difference between the assessor parcel and the legal parcels that keep coming up and causing some confusion.
Okay. Well, just to remind everybody, that's not precisely a Williamson Act issue, but we're happy to address that for you briefly.
Since the assessor was here, maybe that's okay.
Yes, and it's nice to have her here because she'll keep my answer correct and accurate, I'm sure, if I stray off the path a little bit, but I just wanted to give you a little bit of basic information on legal parcels.
Excuse me.
Legal parcels are typically parcels created by a subdivision, and those may be real recent subdivisions, the ones that you approve here at the Planning Commission, but also back in time. And parcels could be created historically by predecessor statutes such as the plat map, the period of time where plat maps actually covered subdivision of land. And also they were variously referred to as parcel maps and tract maps at different periods of time. So remembering that the Subdivision Map Act evolved over many decades, those are legal parcels that we usually think of as a separate conveyable parcel that you can sell to another person without describe the property and record a map, known as a record of survey, when that actually created parcels. But that is no longer the case, and that's just another example of how the law has changed over many decades in terms of how you create a legal parcel. The other issue that you're talking about that's kind of tangled up in here is assessor's parcel numbers. And believe me, we hear this question almost on a daily basis where, well, I have an assessor's parcel number. How come that isn't a legal parcel? This is where I'm going to rely on Lisa to keep me on the straight and narrow.
The number one answer to that is the assessor creates parcels based upon our needs. And sometimes we need to split a legal parcel because the tax rate on one side is different than the tax rate on the other. Tax rate area lines just, they go through the county and there's not a lot of thought about whether a parcel is split by that line. So there are some single family residences that are split by two tax rate areas. And they can have, on their single family residence, they can have two tax bills.
Because they're... county, using the county line example,
well,
or some other
the tax rate area line splits, the district is split in the middle of the property, so each district wants to be sure that they get their correct taxes, and so the property could be split down the middle, and it's one legal parcel, but it's two assessor's parcels.
That's because they have a different tax rate. And
right.
One example that I ran into a while back was, I think it was Community College. Cuesta Community College had a boundary for which it had a special assessment, and one gentleman that had, I think, 3 or 4 acres was actually half in that assessment area and half out of the assessment area, and he thought he had two legal parcels, and we worked with him on that issue. And I think also there was a time when partnerships, if you owned property in partnership with another person, you could actually have, you know, this half of the property assigned to one assessor's parcel number and the bill went to you, and the other portion of the property assigned a different assessor's parcel number and it went to your partner. And I don't know if that's still allowed, but that used to be the case, I think.
Things were very casual in the past, and the assessor's and the assessor's parcel numbers are for the assessor's convenience, not actually anyone else's. So if we got a deed that illegally split property, we would split it, even though maybe it wasn't a legal subdivision. It would still be split by that deed, and each person would then get their bill. We have maybe a different aim than the Planning Commission and planning.
I've got a question. When did the surveyor's record of survey to creating parcels end?
Well, I'm going to have to check that real quickly here. I have a date here somewhere. Yes, there it is. It says that records of survey do not create legal lots of record, except for those completed in 1937 to 1962, to record an approved subdivision or 5 or more lots of 1 acre or less in size. So there's some criteria under which that was actually allowed, and it is, you know, it's very defined, so it isn't all circumstances.
So,
but the window of time was 1937 to 1962, and I'm sure Joe Manson of our office can give you more information, or anybody that's interested in that, because she is our specialist.
Okay, great. The other question, does being in the Williamson Act, does that affect inheritance tax appraisals?
You would have to talk to the IRS, but I don't think the IRS has any sympathy for anybody, so I don't think so.
Okay.
Well, thank you. That helps me a lot, kind of that description of this assessor parcel, legal parcel, even though I understand it's not strictly Williamson here, to have that description of the convenience or the situations where the assessor parcel would be split from the legal parcel, because we trouble over that regularly. So.
And just to conclude, I brought some user's guides for the Planning Commission members, if you'd like to have them, both for certificate of compliance process, which talks about this legal lot issue, and then also on the voluntary merger, which comes up from time to time. Typically, the voluntary mergers are used in a situation where, in order to build something, you need to consolidate smaller parcels that maybe weren't even, you know, don't comprise a single home site. In some cases, particularly on the coast, we'll have fragmentary lots, and it may be that they need to be consolidated into a single building site in order for a person to be able to build a house. And there are some other circumstances under which it may be advantageous for a landowner to voluntary merge a couple of parcels. So I have some information for you. It's pretty detailed, and happy to pass that out here.
Great. Any other questions? One comments in the audience, questions? Okay, well, thank you very much for coming today.
Madam Chair, I thought maybe I would. So occasionally when you have a subdivision that's of contracted land, you have to make these particular findings. And so that's the main area where you get involved, besides also making recommendations on changes to the rules of procedure. That's basically your role.
Thank you. Okay, with that, we'll move on to hearing item number 2. Clerk, will tell us what that is.
Item 2 is a hearing to consider a request by the County of San Luis Obispo to amend the Growth Management Ordinance, Title 26 of the County Code. County file number LRP 2008008, District 24, Joe Manson, Project Manager.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the Commission. I'm John Hofshore, and with me today is Joe Manson. Joe essentially runs our growth management allocation system. We both work at the Permit Center at the Department of Planning and Building. Our purpose here today is we have an ordinance that has a few dates in it, and they are about to expire, and to keep the ordinance accurate and functional, we have to come back to your commission and to the board from time to time. So that's our purpose of being here today, and with that I'll just turn it over to Joe, and she'll walk you through some of these changes.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the Planning Commission. Joe Manson, County Planning Information Services Group. As Mr. Hofshore mentioned, we are here today to amend the Growth Management Ordinance, which is Title 26 of our county code. What I would like to do first, though, is just provide you a brief overview of the Growth Management Ordinance. And if I could ask Mrs. Porter to... There we go. The Growth Management Ordinance was adopted by the board back on October 23, 1990. It establishes a per fiscal year rate of growth set by the Board of Supervisors. The growth rate is consistent with the community resources, which are established by the RMS, the Resource Management System, to support residential growth. Currently, the countywide growth rate is 2.3%. The Napomo Mesa is 1.8%, and currently the Cambria community is 0%. I'd also like to note that the system, it establishes a system for allocating the number of residential construction permits allowed each fiscal year. The allocation system, as Mr. Hofshore mentioned, is managed by planning staff. And the easiest way to explain it is that the allocation request is submitted concurrently when a customer submits their building permit application. As you may be aware, there are exemptions to the Growth Management Ordinance, and some good examples are secondary dwellings, farm support quarters, and affordable housing. We do have waiting list areas within the county. The three are Cambria, Los Osos, and a portion of Cayucas referred to as County Service Area 10A. A little bit of background regarding the particular amendments that we're here today to discuss. On August 12th of last year, 2008, the Board of Supervisors adopted cleanup and housekeeping updates for the Growth Management Ordinance. During that amendment process last year, three amendments were identified, as Mr. Hofshore referenced earlier, that are necessary prior to June the 30th of 2009. The first amendment that we're proposing is to update the fiscal year references for the Napomo Mesa area for fiscal year 2009-2010. Simply the way in which the current text is worded, we would have to come back each year just to note the change in the fiscal year for the upcoming fiscal year. The second proposed amendment is to maintain and extend the 0% Cambria growth rate per fiscal year. The current time frame noted in the Growth Management Ordinance is July 1, 2006 through June 30, 2009. We're proposing that that be changed to July 1, 2009 to June 30, 2012, and that's based both on the 2005 and the 2008 County Resource Management System annual reports. And in those reports, the community of Cambria is noted as being under a water shortage emergency. Planning staff proposed to extend out another 3 years simply as a means of expediency. So the ordinance does not have to be revisited on this particular item until then. One thing that I would like to note,
we have these available in a handout form also.
Yes, okay.
With the corrected language.
Okay. What I have up on the screen right now is the actual Growth Management Ordinance, and I'll use my little hand here to show you. As noted in Section 2 of the amending ordinance, it refers to the text in J1A, and I'll call it little I, and that's actually the paragraph where we're noting the date changes from 2006, 2009 2009-2012, and also the same here. If you just go down three paragraphs, and that will go on to the second page. Whoops. I'm not sure why that's... Okay. Hang on, Jim. There we go.
We don't have this in our packet.
I guess not.
Yeah, for some reason it's not. It was working.
We just have two pages.
You don't have two pages. You don't have that paragraph in your package.
Yeah, we don't have the complete.
The point is that the
there's something else.
The date was there twice. We only thought it was there once, and so we want to catch that.
If we could just have a specific reference to it, so when we make a motion, we can include it in the motion.
Yes, ma'am. In fact, if you look at the screen right now, what I've done is. This is coming up, no technical difficulties. This is an revised amending ordinance where you will see Section 2 is the same Section 2 that we currently have. There are no changes in that. The new Section 3 to be inserted, it's Section 26.01.070J1B, and here is the paragraph, and we're not changing any of the text except for the reference to that other paragraph right above where we changed, the only thing we're changing is the dates for consistency, 2006 to 2009 and 2009 to 2012. And then the rest of the amending ordinance is exactly the same, except, of course, the sections are renumbered. We cleaned it up very well last year, and we forgot we made that clarification update in the freezing of existing waiting list paragraph, and we just need to make sure it's changed for consistency. The third proposed amendment that we're looking at is to extend the allocation waiting list for the community of Los Osos beyond 30 June 2009 to allow more time for completion of a community sewer system. And what I'd like to point out, just so that you know there is precedent for this, historically this date has been changed before given the time frame that has been moving regarding completion of the sewer system. For example, in November of 2003, as part of the growth management cleanup amendments by the board at that time, the estimated completion date in the GMO was December the 30th, 2003. And of course, that date was being passed by, and we realized we need to extend it. At that point in time, they did extend it to the current date in the ordinance of June the 30th, 2009. We realized that that date obviously cannot be met, so we're simply asking for it to be extended again for additional time. And I coordinated with our Public Works Division, and they had given us a tentative estimated date of 2013. So that's the date that we have, you know, proposed for the amendment. And of course, that date can be changed in the future if required. So what we're asking for the Planning Commission today is to recommend to the Board of Supervisors approval of Growth Management Ordinance Amendment LRP 2008-00008, as shown in the exhibit LRP 2008-00008A, based on the recommended findings, however, as amended by planning staff today, to add a new Section 3 for edits for Section 26.01.070J1B and renumber the subsequent sections of the amending ordinance. That concludes my presentation. Thank you.
Thank you. Before we go on and with questions, I just want to announce some ex parte contacts. I have spoken with Daryl Robinson, who represents undeveloped lot owners Unlock Group in Cambria, and I have corresponded with Tammy Rudock, who's general director of the Cambria Community Services District. So with that, are there questions for staff? Questions right now for staff. Okay, with that, we'll move into public comment. I have one speaker slip. Jacob Kohlerman? Kohlerian, thank you.
Good morning, Madam Chair. I'm Dr. Jacob Kohlerian, one of the lot owners in Cambria. I bought my lot about 5 years ago, and I paid the prime price for it. And, you know, we feel... probably there's 600-700 of us. We feel that the 50s And I feel like I will never be able to build on my lot in Cambria. Maybe my son will be able to build it. But what I'm trying to say is we've always been fighting the environmentalists and the no-growth people. And we feel that our voices are not heard, you know, specifically in these times of recession. It seems like logical to bring in new people to the county who would stimulate business, who would put more money in there, bring their children, pay more taxes. So that's our opinion. You know, I don't officially represent the lot owners of Cambria, but I'm sure I do echo all their sentiments, as Daryl Robertson has probably corresponded with you. So I don't understand all the details and intricacies of the process, but we feel like, you know, our voices are not heard, neither in CCSD nor here, and we have suffered a little bit of setback lately with some new members coming into the CCSD board who seem to be anti-growth or zero-growth people. So that's all I have to say.
Thank you. Anyone else here to speak to this item? Seeing no one, I'll bring it back to the commission. Any more questions or comments, or shall I get to mine? Bruce?
Well, I'd just like to talk about what the speaker, Mr. Kalarim, just said. Specifically, what is the issue in Cambria on the water?
Staff want to...
I know that's a big one, but
that one,
you know, I'm somewhat familiar with it, but I'd like to just hear why we need 3 years instead of annual renewal.
The short answer is they have a water shortage, and it became so acute that it became a water shortage emergency. And under the powers of that district, they were able to say no further building. In essence, it's a moratorium, but the legal term is a little different. So they're not issuing any intent to serve letters, which you have to have in your hand before you come to the county for a building permit, according to the statutes. So that's what the problem is. They've been looking for a major new water source for 20 years, maybe even 30 years. They currently take most of their water out of San Simeon Creek. Santa Rosa Creek historically was their first source, but it's less. They want to augment it with a desal plant, and they're now in the second version of that desal. There was one approved years back. I believe it was the early 90s, and there was problems, and it simply never went forward. So they're basically taking a second try at desal. I believe it was 2006, we figured they would need at that time, if everything went well, they would need 3 years. So we put that date in the ordinance, and now we're trying to forecast again. If everything went well for them, they would need another few years. Where we will go with this, and the same in Los Osos or any community where there's a waiting list because of resources, if we're within 6 months of water being in the pipeline or a sewer system being complete, we will come back and amend this accordingly. So none of these projects are going to sneak up on us, and nobody's going to be harmed by a 0% or so forth. So that's maybe a little bit of the background on that.
That leads to my next question. Yes, some relief for these property owners that are caught up in limbo here. Because things didn't go well and water, new sources of water were not brought online in the estimated time frame, has there been any consideration for reassessment of their property values so that they can get some relief on their property taxes?
I don't believe that any of that discussion has come through our department. Any property owner that feels that their value is not correct can go to the assessor and ask to be revalued. And in fact, because of these tough economic times, I understand that department is going through a major effort to reappraise properties according to today's rates rather than the inflated rates of 2 years ago or 3 years ago.
Well, sure, but irregardless of that, if the property was bought years and years ago with an anticipation that there would be water so that there could be a building permit issued, it may be worth even less today since this is being extended out time after time after time. So I would hope that the county assessor's office would give that some real consideration. That's all I have to say. Thank you.
Other questions or comments? So the correspondence I've had points out a sort of subtle distinction here between the sort of best case and the construction of that plant is coming as we get a little closer to the possible completion date.
Just to respond, sure, you can suggest that. It'll become a recommendation to the Board of Supervisors, and they'll have to debate the pros and cons. I would like to say that last year we did a pretty big cleanup on this ordinance, and what we found is that things are happening so slow that we would like to have an ordinance that could last more than 1 year and still be accurate. And so when you put these dates in, what's happening is that the provisions relating to those dates begin to sunset, or they go out of, you know, they're no longer applicable. And it is costly for us to do this. When we charge an applicant $10,000 for a general plan amendment, we are incurring $10,000 every time we have to do this when it's all done. So we're actually moving in the direction of getting the dates out if we can, rather than going the direction that you just suggested.
And I believe you said earlier, if anything changes in the interim time, it could be rolled back.
So absolutely.
So if a water source did become available, mm-hmm. this date of 2000, is it 13 or 12, 2012, wouldn't apply.
And that has happened historically. I've got a list of growth management ordinance about, you know, 4 inches thick, and just looking through how dates have been changed historically, there have been exact that instance where it would have been out further, but they changed it earlier because of circumstances.
And so who would bear the burden of initiating that change if somehow things proceeded and water was set to come online, say, in January before this 0%?
I believe in the past we have. The department incurs that cost.
Okay, so that wouldn't be an extra burden on the property owners then,
no,
too?
In other words, an aggrieved property owner wouldn't have to initiate something like that, because we have been working very closely with the Cambria Community Service District. And I want to go back to something Joe mentioned earlier. We're sort of we're the second step behind the resource management system. Those folks go to the board and they talk about the resources all over the county. They talk about the forecasts, when are things going to come online, are there impediments, things like that. And then what we do is we draft the administrative mechanism to meter out those permits with the growth management ordinance. So we're sort of step two of this coordinated effort. Both of us work very closely with these districts, and frankly, these large capital improvement programs like the Cambria DSAL and Los Osos Sewer, these are fairly slow-moving objects, and so we don't see we could make a change far quicker than they can complete the last sewer lateral. So
you gave a reason for going 2 or 3 years on several projects. What about Napomo? Do you think that's a reality, that it might change in a year? Why not go 3 years for Napomo?
When we did the cleanups and what we also refer to as housekeeping updates last year, on the advice of County Council, the wordage, and if you'll note on page 2-2 of your staff report under discussion item number 1, the way in which it's read, we only just have to note that it's the upcoming fiscal year, and they felt that it was very important that we keep those dates in the growth management ordinance, that we couldn't just say it'll be 1.8% for the next fiscal year. We actually have to physically put in the fiscal year reference. We had tried to do that.
But the question is, why wouldn't that get shifted to a three fiscal year period?
Historically, we've done it on a year-by-year basis. Similar situation in that case, you know, water you know, services being available. We've just done it on a year-by-year basis. The reason we had put it out as a proposed amendment for 3 years for Cambria was back in 2006 when they were doing the North Coast area update and all. They, at that time, had put it forward from 2006 to 2009, so we were just following that particular same format for Cambria.
Plus three.
For the three-year period.
So at this time, no change then on the NAPOMO one-year proposal. You intend to carry that, or you intend to maybe shift that to a three-year period at a later date? But
based upon our coordination with County Council, just changing that each fiscal year is sufficient. Just to note that it's 1.8% for the ensuing upcoming fiscal year. Okay. That has not been a problem.
Okay. Well, my comment is I think this point is probably moot because under the best case scenario, the desal plant could come.
Move that we, the Commission, recommend to the Board of Supervisors approval of the Growth Management Ordinance Amendment LRP 2008-00008 as shown in Exhibit LRP 2008-00008A and including the additional section left out as delineated today by Ms. Manson, if that's good enough language, because I didn't get the exact reference. But anyway, based on the recommended findings listed in this report.
Okay, can we have a second? Okay. Any more discussion or comments? Okay, clerk will call.
Commissioner Christensen?
Aye.
Commissioner Melskow?
Yes.
Commissioner White?
Yes.
Vice Chairperson Wyatt?
Yes. Okay, so with that carries, and it's now 10 o'clock, so we will move to item number 3.
Want
to take a break now?
Would you
okay.
like to take a
All
break
right.
now?
Okay. With that, we'll take a break now then. 15 minutes and be back at 10:15.
Thank you, Joe. Nice to meet you.
Item 4, the setting appeal of a planning director determination to 14 May. So if anybody is here in the audience or tuned in watching us, again, item number 4, the setting appeal, has been continued to 14 May. With that, we'll move on to our item number 3. The clerk will announce that.
Item 3 is a hearing to consider a request by John and Victoria Dallaire for a conditional use permit.
Item 4, the setting.
Deja vu.
Spend that one. Way too much.
County file number DRC 20070149, District 1, Holly Phipps, project manager.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the Planning Commission, Holly Phipps, planning staff. This is a request by John and Victoria Dallaire for, our slides are not up, for a conditional use permit to allow for an excavating business. The proposed project proposes the construction of two buildings that would have a combined total of approximately 14,000 square feet. The buildings would be used for shop, office, and storage spaces. Outside uses proposed include a covered work area, parking lot, a graded area to be used as a storage yard, and a fuel pad area for above-ground fuel tank. The proposed project is located off of Valopi Isabel, approximately a quarter mile east of Highway 101, and it is located within the community of Templeton. The proposed project is located in industrial land use category and is located in the Salinas River planning area. Here we have a look at the site plan, and Valopi Isabel is over here. Shop, offices, covered work area. This building back here would be for the shop, fuel pad area, detention basin. Quick look at the office elevations. You can see that it's industrial in nature. Shop elevations. Quick look at the aerial view. You can see that the whole area is very industrial in nature. close up. The site is this parcel right here. A few pictures. This is looking into the site and the fence that runs along the Valopi Isabel. And then this is just right inside the fence area looking at the current state of the site. Again, just a few more pictures. We can see that we have some piles of dirt and stuff used for the business. Staff does have a few changes to the staff report. Staff would like to add a new condition 13, and staff had asked our administrative assistants to pass that out to you guys before the hearing. And also on page 312, staff would like to delete number 8. Apparently that was left over from a track change. With that, staff is requesting adoption of the negative declaration in accordance with CEQA and requesting approval of conditional use permit based on the findings listed in Exhibit A and the findings listed in Exhibit B. And staff is available for questions.
Thank you. Are there some questions?
Yeah, I don't. The one of the conditions you wanted to add, I don't have a copy of that.
It's not. I haven't seen it either.
It's not in our edition. So could you tell us more about it?
Yes. Pertinent. The new condition, prior to issuance of the building permit for Phase 2, the applicant shall pay inclusionary housing fees pursuant of...
Second here to speak to this project, a representative. Hello. If you will, turn in a speaker slip when you're done.
Certainly.
I'll get one.
And can we switch over the presentation to you? It's just plugged in here, so I don't know if...
Did you?
We'll see. Is that podium 1 or podium 2? There you
there
go.
It is.
Is there a way to make it a little larger on the screen to get the full size? Thanks.
Good morning, Commissioners. My name is Eric Ward. I'm an Associate Planner with Oasis Associates, here representing the Dallaires for their conditional use permit. I'd like to thank Holly for her work on the presentation and staff report. The applicant is respectfully requesting that you adopt the mitigative negative declaration and conditional use permit based upon the 4 findings and conditions. The project was originally approved in 2001, and due to some unfortunate circumstances, the permit was allowed to lapse. The project is back before the commission today with a 13% increase in original conditions and a 42% increase in stock conditions. Nonetheless, we accept the conditions of approval and are committed to comply with them with the exception of condition number 2. The applicant would like to add add slatted chain link fencing to the list of approved methods of screening. I have a couple slides here showing the adjacent properties and the type of fencing that they have. The photo on the left is unit asphalt, and it is to the west of the project site on Valpe Isabel. They have chain link with a landscape buffer. Unit asphalt is also located to the east of the project with just chain link fencing. Across the street, you have Kritz Excavating and Trucking with green slatted chain link fencing and minimal landscaping, and then Granite Construction with a bit more landscaping than green slatted chain link fencing. Oasis Associates was also the agent for the Granite Construction project that came before the Commission in 2003. At that time, the Commission approved the modification to the Land Use Ordinance Section 2230560 because the slatted chain link fencing and landscaping combination provided effective visual screening, better security, and was compatible with adjacent property fencing. The applicant is respectfully requesting that you adopt the mitigative negative declaration and conditional use permit along with the modification to the land use ordinance. And I am happy to address any questions before the close of public comment. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Any questions for the applicant? Okay. Anyone from the public here to speak to this item? Don't have any speaker slips in. Okay. Seeing no one, I'll bring it back to the commission. Are there questions for staff, the applicant, discussion?
My only question is the applicant's request on condition 2. Does staff have any concerns with that?
We actually don't. The chain link with slats would be comparable to other fencing in the area. Strict interpretation of the ordinance findings, we didn't believe we could make. So that's why we suggested that they do the solid fencing.
Of the findings as far as screening that...
Yes, on 3-3, page 3-3, at the bottom of page 3-3, describes the findings necessary to waive solid fencing. One is the site of the storage yard abuts a railroad right-of-way, which this site does not. And the second finding is the surrounding terrain would make fencing ineffective or unnecessary. So that may be a finding we could make. It's not really the surrounding terrain, but the surrounding properties, I would say. It's a little bit of a stretch, so we wanted your commission to weigh in on that. Correct. Yeah, we could make that finding.
Okay. I guess there's that question though in wording.
Yeah.
Terrain. It's not worded neighborhood here. It is worded terrain, and so I would guess terrain would be more slope or shrubbery or something other than the neighbor's fences, which is what staff was interpreting here.
Neighboring fencing.
Well, if it said consistent with neighborhood or neighboring fencing, that would be a clear call. But I don't consider the neighbor's fences the terrain. I don't think that's close. I don't think neighbor's fences are under the definition of terrain, really.
Sorry, Karen Nall again. Here's a photo of the existing fence. Staff would have no issue if this would be beefed up with landscaping and just leave the fence there, the existing fence there.
And so this is a slatted chain link, is the existing.
It would basically look like the granite construction fencing here with the oleanders and small trees. The landscape plan is here. So you can see along Volpe Isabel to the right of the slide, that's where our landscaping would go in there.
That's the street side there.
Correct.
And so that's spacing, I can't tell what the spacing is on that. I see it looks like some smattering of trees then, and I'm taking it the small circles are oleander.
Correct.
And each commissioner, I believe you have a large size copy. There should be a landscaping plan in your packet there that might be helpful.
You didn't get one in color?
Looks like just black and white. Okay, so we have landscaping, and I'm not hearing any comments sounding as if people are not satisfied with these circles on the landscape plan. Well, other questions, comments?
The elevation of the granite construction, if it mirrors that looked appropriate to me. I've just asked staff to insert the appropriate language in the conditions and findings to allow for this.
Other issues, comments? Nice clean report. Okay,
I would like to make one more. I heard Commissioner Christian say it's a nice clean report. I had the same thoughts when I read it, so I compliment Holly and the rest of the staff on that. And I did pick up that we got some detailed information on the advisory groups. And
Excuse me, I think your mic isn't on. Thank you.
I'm sorry.
We're not getting you on the...
I'm sorry. I'll repeat that then. I did hear Commissioner Christensen compliment the staff report, and I had the same thoughts when I read it. It was real thorough, and I did have some concerns that, as I read through the report, they were covered. So, and I did see we got some detailed information on the community advisory groups, and that's finally gotten in here, so that's great. So with that, I'll make a motion that we adopt the negative declaration in accordance with the applicable provisions of the California Environmental Quality Act, Public Resources Code Section 21,000, and approve conditional use permit DRC 2007-00149 based on the findings listed in Exhibit A as modified and the conditions listed in Exhibit B as modified.
Okay, and so to be clear, let's just again read those into the record. We had several changes. Item condition 2, if staff will read that change into the record.
Staff's proposing just to delete condition 2, because we don't need a revised site plan at all.
Since that was for the fence, that allows the fence that is existing. Okay, and then we also deleted the old item 8 and added new... condition 12, as read by staff for inclusionary housing
Correct.
Payment.
And we deleted old number 12.
We renumbered.
Renumbered.
So did I hear we're deleting condition 2?
Yes.
So we'll need to renumber all the way through.
Oh, true.
Good to work these things through. Better now than having to figure it out later. So deleting... So, yes, yeah, got that. Okay, is there a second for that motion, then?
I hadn't heard a second.
Okay,
no.
I'll second. Okay, so motion by White, seconded by Christensen. Any more comments? Okay, the clerk will call the roll.
Commissioner White?
Yes.
Commissioner Christensen?
Yes.
Commissioner Melskow?
Yes.
Vice Chairperson Wyatt?
Yes. While staff is moving, I will again just announce that we have continued item 4, the setting appeal of planning director determination at Ocean Sea Pines Gulf has been continued to 14 May. Steph, ready?
5.74 acres of site disturbance, which includes both grading and vegetation removal, so that brings it into the conditional use permit area. The project is for work that was unpermitted, so that is as-built work. It was done prior to the application submittal. The project site is southeast of the Creston area off of La Ponza Road, a few miles west of where La Ponza meets Highway 58, and the access is taken off of a road called Quail Valley Lane. And this is the land use category map. The Patinode property is outlined in black, and it is in the rural lands land use category. The other portion of the project site is the easement through another property that's under the ownership of Morrison Jolicoeur, and that is also in the rural lands land use category. But I should also note that there is a planning area boundary that separates the two, so that the access road is in the El Pomar Estrella planning area, but the property itself is in the Shandon Carrizo planning area. So the planning area standards are slightly different for one part of the project and for the other. This is an aerial image from 2003 showing the project site. The Patinode parcel, again, is outlined in black. And you can see from this aerial that the vegetation communities are largely chaparral-based, chamise, scrub, with manzanita, blue oaks, and grape pines. And then this is an aerial image from 2007 after the majority of the site work was done. The project is primarily for the access road going from Quail Valley Lane, starting down here, up through this parcel to the proposed building site, which is located where this yellow star is. And this slide is showing the scope of this project. It is the road shown in orange, along with the vegetation removal that was done to accommodate the road and for the building site as well. And that total comes to 5.74 acres based on staff's calculation. The project was done without permits, and this is a few images of the erosion that had occurred on the site. This is probably a worst-case scenario. These pictures were taken in January after some significant rainstorms. They're not representative of what's on the site today because there has been
substantial regrowth of vegetation. But this does show an example of the erosion that staff had addressed in the staff report. And there's a few images of this. And we had also discussed a sedimentation of a tributary creek that is under Fish and Game jurisdiction. And these are a few images of that as well. And this is the location for the proposed building site on the patented parcel. And then I'm going to quickly go through the grading plans because the PowerPoints don't show a whole lot of detail, but this shows where essentially we're going along the access road from the building site down to Quail Valley Lane. And so this is where the residence is proposed right here, and then the next few slides are of the access road. The length is roughly 0.8 mile. And staff's recommendation is that your commission adopt the mitigated declaration and approve the conditional use permit based on the findings in Exhibit A and the conditions in Exhibit B. We did do an initial study, and there were mitigation measures involved with that the applicant has agreed to, and those have been incorporated into the conditions of approval. So that concludes my presentation. I'm available for any questions.
Thank you. Questions for staff? Straight up. I'm going to hold mine, too, till after we've heard from the applicant in public. So is the applicant or agent here to speak? While the applicant's getting ready, I do have an ex parte meeting to announce. Commissioner White and I did take a site visit with the agent and applicant on Monday. So.
And I'll acknowledge that also. Okay.
Good morning. Members of the Commission, my name is Jamie Kirk, and I'm representing the Patnodes this morning. And I would like to thank the two commissioners that came out for our site visit this week. I think that served a great purpose. And to start with an introduction, as Mr. Conger stated, this is an application for a grading permit for an access road for a single-family residence in the rural lands land use category. The site disturbance is the trigger for the conditional use permit, and that's why we're before you today. I think there's a lot of information in the record. I'm sure you've read it that our position, we have a different position than staff on the amount of site disturbance, whether it was over 3 acres or under 3 acres, but in working towards getting Mr. Patnode his permit and getting through the process, I think we just all agreed to disagree on that point and move forward to bring the item to your commission. So what we're requesting of the commission today is that you install the road. That being said, in April of 2005, the Patnode family purchased the property. That property included that easement across the Morse property. In 2006, when Mr. Patnode owned the property, there were some improvements that were done by the neighbor, because recognizing this is owned by the Joel Kears. And there were some improvements that were done to this portion of the road, including some debrushing and compaction. And then this portion of the road was extended to the Patnode for the access for improvements to the water source and fencing. And the Patnodes relocated out from New York in late 2006, got all their information together for their building permit, submitted their building permit in April 2007. And then upon staff review, it came in as an as-built grading permit. Upon staff review, it determined that it triggered a major grading permit. The major grading permit, because slopes were over 10%, submitted for that permit. And then through that plan check process, there came the minor use permit requirement because grading was over 1 acre, the site disturbance trigger for a minor use permit. So that was submitted in 2007. That's whenever our office became involved. They wanted some assistance on getting the minor use permit in and didn't know quite what to do, so we helped them with that. Submitted that December 21st, 2007. We worked with county planning, several different information requests provided information, clarification on site disturbance, biological resources, the limits of grading, et cetera. And then we received the information that a determination was made by staff that the grading was over 3 acres, so we had to apply for a conditional use permit. So that's how we ended up before you today. With that, we've reviewed the conditions. We're pleased to be here today getting to resolution on the project. We have two modifications to conditions. We'll start with condition number 7. Condition number 7 is a requirement for an erosion drainage plan, grading plan, drainage plan, erosion and sedimentation control plan. We're fine with that. That's what's in plan check, what we submitted. It's not in plan check yet, but that's what we submitted to the county back in several times now. So that's in. But the question that we have is, we have a requirement for a long-term erosion control methods be incorporated, and the staff report came up with almost 900 plants that would have to be installed for this long-term erosion. And I think our position is that we've got existing vegetation that's occurring on the site that meets the requirement, and that we're concerned that by going in and by planting those trees, you're going to be having to remove that existing vegetation. And so that's going to disrupt the regrowth that's occurring, as well as the root systems, and in itself cause erosion. And not to mention, we're going to have to somehow get a water source down to water these plants. So what we did is we had Mr. Patnod went out and took some pictures yesterday just to show you, you know, what's going on the site today. You can see that there's vegetation regrowth and shrubs are coming up. So I think the long-term erosion is addressed by the existing site conditions. The second condition is condition 8, and this relates to a remedial action plan for the removal of sediment in the unnamed tributary to Quail Water Creek. This is where the culvert is installed. This culvert is not on the Patnod property. It's on the neighbor's property. While we have an access easement to cross the neighbor's property, the extent of that easement doesn't allow us to get in there and do the remediation required by this condition. As I showed you in the pictures, there's a revegetation that's occurring on site, and the erosion control plan has been looked at by it's part of the stormwater pollution prevention plan. It's been to Regional Water Quality Control Board. Department of Fish and Game has looked at it. NRCS has looked at the site. And our position is that the improvements and the existing improvements and the erosion control is satisfactory. And all the other agencies that we've worked with, they haven't required us to do any additional work. They're satisfied with the plans as is, with no further action being required. And again, that's the culverted area. With that, that's going to conclude my presentation. We'd like to request that the commission approve the grading permit with the condition modifications. I'm obviously here to answer questions. Mandy Pickens, with my staff who's been working most directly on this project, as well as our project biologist, Mike McGovern, our civil engineer, John Kudla, and the owners. So thank you.
Thank you. Are there others who've come to speak to this item? I don't have any other speaker slips, but you're welcome to come on up. Anyone else here? I see a number of people.
Well, I think the intent of having our team here is we didn't want to spend your commission's time going through, having each professional do a presentation, but if you have a specific resource-related question.
So who wants to be first with questions?
I just had a couple questions on the
sure.
on the replanting. The way I understand Ms. Kirk's presentation, I'd like to get some clarification. You'd like to strike Condition 8 entirely?
Yes.
Your proposal would be to strike Condition 8?
Correct. Condition 8 is the remedial action plan that deals with trying to go in and pull the small amount of sediment that's in the creek out.
It's off-site. It's not on their property.
It's not on our property.
And then on Condition 7, how would you like to modify that?
The condition, it would be to omit the last two sentences.
Okay.
We're fine with the first sentence because we've done that.
Sure.
And that's in.
And then that leads, that covers the replanting. And when Commissioner Wyatt and I were on site, we did see all the regrowth. And mm-hmm. and it did appear that it might be more damage than good if it started disturbing the natural growth that's occurred in this two-year time frame or however long it's been. But I also saw Condition 20 about the oak tree replanting. Is there any concerns about replanting the oak trees?
Well, obviously, there's quite a few oak trees that need to be planted on the site, and it would be our preference to not to have to replant that many trees. And that we didn't specifically request a modification to that condition because we understand that that is a standard that has been applied on other projects. But it is, I believe there were 70 some odd trees that
74
trees that had to be removed. So I think if we had our preference, one to one replacement would be preferred as opposed to 2 to 1.
Well, one of my questions was, it talks about disturb, but when we were on site, we were seeing, new foliage coming out on
right.
these trees that were, the grading was done within the drip line. I only saw maybe one or two that was real close to the trunk of the tree. It looks like most of them were several feet off the road. So, it's hard for me because, I've been around construction and development here my whole adult life, and prior to that, I grew up in the North County and hunt and fished on ranches and so forth, and this kind of conflicts with what my practical experience is. And I'm not an expert in biological resources by any stretch, but I just don't see where damage of a great extent occurred here. And one of the things that just seems unfair to me was condition 28 with a 7-year monitoring of these impacted oak trees or the replanting.
I see, Commissioner White, I see Mr. Null here, and so maybe he's the point person then to sort of answer some of these blue oak impact questions.
I certainly am, Madam Chair. I'm John Null. I'm your principal environmental specialist. I think we're on a little bit of a slippery slope here because the applicant did agree in the developer's statement to this level of tree mitigation. And so if we're going to change that, we're really going to be changing the negative declaration. What I heard the applicant's agents say was they're not opposed to fulfilling this mitigation. And I think that because they agreed to it, it's my opinion and my recommendation that your commission hold them to that mitigation.
Mr. Naldo, maybe you can just fully elaborate for us on where this sort of number 2-to-1 replacement comes from, because it
sure.
is outside of the drip line a bit, and so maybe you can just explain.
Let me give you a general overview, and I'll turn it over to Michael because he's probably more informed as to the specific situation on the site. But whenever we have removal of an oak tree, then the county's policy is that we replace that oak tree at a 4-to-1 ratio. Really what we're mitigating there is the loss of habitat that occurs when an oak tree is removed. When we have a situation where an oak tree is going to be impacted, we're not sure if it's going to result in the demise of that oak tree. It's simply going to be impacted, such as its root zone is going to be impacted within an area that's 1.5 times the diameter of the canopy. If that occurs, then we require a 2-to-1 replacement. We see that sort of thing with trees alongside a road, in an area where a driveway may go through the drip line. That's a 2-to-1 type replacement. Michael, did you have anything to add on the specifics in this case?
No, I don't believe so.
Right.
Although I will also point out that we consider the root zone to be 1.5 times the drip line by convention.
Right.
And so that's a standard then in county code, the 1.5 times.
I'm not sure if it's actually in county code, but it's been our practice for CEQA.
Okay, because that's something that came up on the tour with the applicant is the various requirements in different jurisdictions for what the impact zone is exactly and how that...
Impacting, because we did the 4-to-1 replacement for the tree that was removed in Templeton. I don't remember any continuing monitoring of those replanting. So in the sake of consistency, where we lost a 48-inch oak tree, I would like to, and I made the statement in that hearing that I would hope that we would be consistent because I was in disagreement with how that tree was handled, and I was assured that we would strive for consistency.
And I may defer to Mr. Null on this one as well, but I believe we start doing the monitoring, we start triggering that depending on the number of trees that are being replaced. If it's a small number, then usually monitoring isn't warranted, but if there's a large number of replacement trees, then we start adding that as a condition.
Madam Chair, I would chime in that if your commission wishes to reduce the number of years of monitoring, I certainly wouldn't want you to reduce it to zero, but in a case like this, maybe 5 years would be appropriate if that seems reasonable.
Is there a standard? I'm guessing it's some stock kind of terms, then it's some number, as Mr. Conway
generally
suggested.
That number is 5. But that is for a lesser number of trees. But if your commission feels like seven is excessive, then staff would recommend five.
Okay. Well, since we're on this, then maybe we need to just keep going. So are there comments from other commissioners on the number of years of monitoring or the tree requirement?
Yeah. I'm kind of back where staff was in the sense that, first of all, I do appreciate applicant's presentation. I really appreciate the clarification of the timeline. That was good. The applicant has asked for modifications or changes or elimination of two conditions, which we have not talked about. They have not even mentioned this condition 19 and 20, and I'm inclined to leave it as it is. We do have a situation where we have had some, this isn't as-built permit. This is not a proactive permit, and I understand that a lot of the work that we're concerned about was done before these owners came onto this property or bought this property, and that some of the stuff we're concerned about isn't even on their property, but it was only within their easement. So I got to tell you, I'm not really inclined to change or modify conditions that the applicant themselves has already agreed to, that the mitigated neg deck is based on, and that no one's asked us to change. So that's kind of where I'm in that
okay.
one. And then we can go and talk about the other two that they have asked about.
The only question I had about the 74 trees, are there suitable sites for this number of trees? Has that been determined?
I'd like to turn this over to Mike McGovern, the biologist. This is his area of expertise.
All right, thank you.
Good morning, I'm Mike McGovern, and I've been to the site a couple of times as a biologist to look at the trees that may have been disturbed on that 150% outside the drift line. And as some of you have seen, have been up there, the trees, no trees have been removed, and the trees right now seem to be doing quite fine of those that are in the report, the 30-some trees that were mentioned as possibly disturbing the drip line. So, and it's, the county has their mandate of the 2-to-1 replacement, which is fine, and it's to replace any habitat or potential habitat that could be lost. And this road went in a while ago, and the trees seem to be doing quite fine. And to be specific, to answer your question is, where do you put 74 extra trees? If you stick them within the canopy that's there, they'll probably stay small and stunted until the over canopy is released and the sunlight comes through and they can grow. So they'd be sitting there, and they may not do very much. And during that time, there could be just natural recruitment, which does happen. And I've looked at the site in general, and it is a lot of sagebrush and chaparral, a lot of south-facing, and that would probably be somewhat inappropriate to plant some blue oaks to try to get them established unless they're maintained for quite a lengthy period of time and maybe into greater than 7 years. So I don't know if there is an appropriate place to have them grow, in a room that's on the property, that is.
Here's a question then. Somebody doesn't mind me interrupting. It says that the mitigation is for trees that are impacted, and it says 37 blue oaks were designated as impacted, and that was basically strictly based on measurement of drip line. I mean, in other words, are we talking about a theoretical impaction, or are we talking about an actual, literally impacted? And does it make a difference to the county?
Well, you said 4-to-1. 4-to-1 is if there's a removal.
No, two. Okay. I'm just saying the idea is it says the tree mitigation plan shall provide to the planting in kind of a 2-to-1 ratio for oak trees designated for impact, not removal. This is condition 20A. 37 blue oaks were designated as impacted.
Where oak trees have been removed or oak trees have been impacted. There is no guarantee that volunteer oaks are going to result in adequate mitigation such as we ask the applicant to agree to in the developer's statement. And if the applicant's botanist or biologist feels that there are not appropriate places on the site to plant those trees, then I would suggest that we add a condition that requires a plan prepared by a professional or an expert that indicates where those replacement trees should be planted.
So noted. More questions on it?
Commissioner Melskow.
What if he feels that he cannot find adequate planting sites on that property?
In my opinion, I seriously doubt, given the size of this property and the different aspects and just the sheer size of this property, that there are places that the oak trees can be replanted.
Okay, but what if he decides there isn't?
We can formulate a condition that could require off-site mitigation for the planting of those trees, if necessary. And I'll look to Bill and Michael to be drafting something to that effect.
Thank you. Well, more on that? More for the biologist?
No.
Mr.
No more
McGovern? Anything else for Mr. McGovern while he's up here? Did you want have anything else to add, Mr. McGovern?
No.
Thank you.
Got those two checked off here.
More on your list?
Mm-hmm. Again, I was happy to see that we've got some detailed information from the advisory bodies that I know Commissioner Wyatt and I have both asked for, and that's really nice. And I'd like to refer to page 5-94. And a question for staff is, how did the community of Creston receive this? I don't have a lot of history on this project. I met out there one time. That's the first I'd talked to anyone about it. How do they feel about the patent notes? I look at their conclusionary remarks, and it looks like they're, you know, I think there's a feeling that that they've been drugged through it here, that they've been through a whole lot, and I'd just like to get staff's response to that.
Well, I was actually not present for the Creston Advisory Board meeting where they rendered these decisions, so essentially I have the same information in front of me that you do. From my interpretation of this, it sounds like they are in support of the project.
Okay. Thank you. I think that's it for now.
Jean?
I have just a couple questions about Condition 7 and Condition 8. I'm just wondering if staff has a response to the request for removal of those second two sentences of Condition 7. And then my question on Condition 8, I am concerned about the sedimentation on the creek. We didn't have any pictures. I don't know if either you two had a chance to see the sedimentation in this creek. I just want to hear a little bit more about that before we start talking about taking out a condition that refers to it. And is there a legal way to have applicants address a area that's not in under their ownership, although it is apparently under has some relation to their easement?
Maybe that would be a good starting point. And so, counsel or Mr. Nall, who wants to handle that question?
That Mr. Orton take a crack at control over that creek bed within that easement.
Yeah, so let's start there. Again, going backwards, the question is the creek that we've seen the sedimentation in is under the easement on the neighbor's property. So the suggestion is that maybe some remediation work should be done, but it's not actually the patent owner's, the applicant's property. So what rights do they have, or do we have to impose some requirements there?
Well, you can impose reasonable on-site and off-site conditions, and they could be required to get an easement to do certain items. I think this the circumstances that I was hearing under which that area was disturbed, you know, may lead you to whether it's reasonable to require them to go into the creek to correct that. I don't know what staff has heard from Department of Fish and Game, and I would defer to what contacts they've had there. It's a legal problem if they don't own the property and going on and doing that work. They'd have to get permission to do so.
So it would be a matter of getting the permission. Is the adjacent property owner here Morse or Jekyllator, is it? Neither adjacent owner is here now to address that. So if we did impose that condition to do something there and the applicant was not able to get permission from the property owner, where would that leave the applicant?
Well, they could ask for a reconsideration of the condition.
Thanks.
My name is Mike Hill. I'm an environmental scientist with the Department of Fish and Game.
and I'm responsible for writing stream bed alteration agreements for Monterey, San Luis Obispo, and San Benito counties.
Okay, no. Mr. Hill, I know we have some correspondence from you in the record, and the last piece of correspondence, in fact, commenting on the matter, but maybe you could just, since you're here, give us your suggestion on how we might proceed or whether you feel like there's any condition that would be helpful for that crossing.
And forgive me for coming in a couple of minutes late, but I want to verify. This is for the culvert on the stream on the road that is leading to the Patnos property. Is that
correct?
That's
correct, on the adjacent property.
Okay. I went out and visited the site last year, and when I saw the site, we felt that a stream bed agreement should be required for that type of activity. However, as I understand it, I subsequently learned that that culvert was installed either prior to the Patnos owning the property or prior to the existing landowner purchasing the property, and I could not see any kind of evidence that the Patnos or the existing landowner were responsible for putting it in. We also had an unfortunate instance when the warden went out there and felt that it wasn't even a stream at all. And so he said he wasn't going to enforce a stream bed alteration agreement violation on that property. That's kind of like me going on safari without bullets. If I tell somebody he needs a stream bed alteration agreement for a site and the warden won't enforce it, I have, you know, no way of enforcing that action. So we decided in this particular instance, and in this particular instance only, we were going to not require a stream bed alteration agreement for that culvert in this at that site.
And Mr. Hill, will you clarify, is that determination then based on the fact that you believe the construction was done by a previous property owner, or is that because you don't think the situation warrants some kind of alteration?
That kind of action would, in my opinion, require a stream bed alteration agreement, yes. But you are correct. I don't believe that that particular owner did that action, and I don't think we can hold somebody responsible for something.
I think that's a relevant question, Ms. Jordan. This comes up repeatedly. Well, I didn't do it. The last guy did it. Does that alleviate their responsibility to clean up the mess? I would guess not. Does it matter really in the end who did it if there's a mess there?
Well, I was. From what the Fish and Game individual testified to, it didn't sound like they were requiring a permit.
We are not.
So.
But my question is just maybe for the future, because this comes up repeatedly, the question of who did it. And it sounds like they're not requiring it, and based on a belief that it wasn't the current property owners who did the deed. But is that really relevant to the call on whether something needs to be cleaned up?
Well, it sounded like there was also a disagreement about whether one would be required for that also. I think when you're, if a permit would have been required for it and it was not done by the earlier property owner, I think you could require it to be done now, but I think it's up to you to use your judgment about what you think is reasonable in this case in light of the testimony.
Right, but the reasonable argument isn't really, it's certainly there's a distinction on to whether anything needs to be done, but really the whether it was this property owner or the last property owner who made the mess isn't relevant to that decision.
Well, I think they're considering that and when they weigh all the factors.
Consideration. My question to the Fish and Game gentleman here is, what about the sedimentation? I haven't actually seen it with my own eyes. How much sedimentation is there? Is it getting worse? Is it something that we should, I mean, in your opinion, is it something we should have the applicants address if possible? And if it's not possible, then that's the way it goes. But do you have any opinions on any of that stuff?
Actually, I do. When I visited the site, and just for your information, I am a certified professional in erosion and sediment control, and I use that extensively in my job. When I visited the site, I gave some recommendations for shoring up the site and helping to prevent sediment and erosion at the site. If it looks like it does in this particular photograph today, I would suggest that it needs some more work on it. from a sediment and erosion control standpoint, but not from a not from the 1602 requirement standpoint.
Will you elaborate on that distinction then, 1602
versus being a streambed alteration agreement? I agree that it needs to have some erosion control work done, if it looks like it does today, and that's why I provided some of the...
Not now.
I think the applicant took some photos yesterday, and we saw those earlier.
That would be relevant. And then after that, maybe we could also get the wording of Condition 8 up there.
This is what it looks like today, right there.
Then maybe we could go to the Condition number 8 as worded, so Mr. Hill could look at that and speak to changes or to modifications to it.
Number... What I'm trying to get at is there was a picture in our staff report of the creek filled with mud, and I want to know what does it look like now and whether something can be done, should be done, could be done, whatever, to the creek. We're not talking about the culvert. Maybe it's the same thing, but I don't think so. That's what I'm concerned about, is this unnamed creek.
I have not seen the creek filled with mud. I have not seen a sediment problem in that creek on the one visit that I conducted to the site.
Okay. That's helpful to me. So, Mike, I guess my thought is that I want to talk to staff about what they think about number 8, but it seems to me that number 7, drainage plan, erosion and sedimentation control plan, those are the things that we're talking about that we really need to be worried about for the future, as opposed to the specific unnamed creek. It's really that easement and how it goes forward in the future, given rains and everything else, and whether there's enough there and whether it's going to be in place long enough there to deal with any problems that are there, were there, or might be there in the future. That's kind of where I'm going. Okay. I think I'm finished with questions.
Okay, well, I guess I was still looking for some kind of response because I heard Mr. Hill suggesting that we do have some kind of conditioning on cleanup of the creek, short of a full streambed.
No, he said he has not seen the creek. He's talking about he's concerned about the culvert area.
Again, I have only seen the creek on one occasion at the culvert site. At that time, there was no sediment, put in the creek channel. So I did not see it, as you described, full of mud. So I can't comment on anything that might be done to remove sediment from the creek at this time because I'm not familiar with any of it.
Okay, but so you were talking about the culvert area then,
as opposed
to the creek itself.
Correct.
I understand the distinction now. And so do our conditions then, 7 and 8, as you look at those, seem to, as if they would address your concerns, or is there a modification on that may be helpful?
Give me just a minute to go through 7. Seven looks fine to me because I think that any place should have a good erosion and sediment control plan to protect, beneficial uses of the water. 8, I want to make sure I understand, is this prior to issuance of the grading permit for the entire site? Are you talking about a remedial action for the culvert? What remedial action are we talking about?
Staff have a response there.
Actually, if I could direct your attention to page 5-11 of the staff report, that kind of gives the background on why we have this condition in place. There's a section that's taken from the grading ordinance that's indented there in a different font, and it was our intention that this condition would satisfy that standard in the ordinance. As far as sedimentation goes, we really don't know what the extent of the sedimentation is. We'd want someone to look into that when they're doing the remedial action plan. And I expect this possibly would go beyond the culvert area.
Beyond the culvert area into the creek? is what you're suggesting, possibly, or
someone would have to determine what the extent of the sedimentation was.
So since that's still not clear, that's the worry of the applicant, that that's a slippery slope, not knowing and not being under control of the adjacent parcel.
Correct. I mean, we don't, the patents don't own the property. We don't have easement to access it. And just for clarification, when we're showing the pictures, that existing picture of the culvert, it's my understanding that that's the area that the culvert and the unnamed tributary to Quail Water Creek are one and the same. That's the same area. So we're talking about that one same area that you observed, Ms. White, whenever we were standing there out on site.
We don't think we're in the same spot here.
No, I didn't know that.
Yeah, I think I was hearing maybe some confusion from Commissioner.
Recommendations then for changes to either of these? You did sound like you do feel like the conditions are reasonable then.
Can you put them back up, please, for a second?
Yes, they're up on screen, 7 and 8.
Again, I don't have an objection to 7. It sounds like that's already been done. Is that?
The applicant's requesting to strike the last two sentences of 7 and strike 8 in its entirety. And that's what we're looking at.
For the benefit of Mr. Hill, I think he came in late and wasn't here for the reasoning. I'd like for him to hear the reason why we were requesting striking the long-term erosion control. As staff did their calculation, it came up to over 900 shrubs and trees that were going to need to be planted. So our concern is we've got natural vegetation establishing out on the site. We've got a root fabric happening out there, and if we start installing 900 trees and shrubs, we're disrupting that root system that's working towards addressing the long-term erosion right now. That was our only concern.
And I'm going to take a step back and just clarify something. I'm speaking strictly from the stream bed alteration program. I'm not representing our CEQA staff, Deb Hilliard, or formerly Dave Hacker, some of the others. I'm looking strictly at the culvert itself. That's the part that I have the authority to speak on. The rest of it, I really don't have the authority to speak on. So I can't speak for the department as far as the appropriateness of striking or not striking those particular provisions. I wanted to come here today just to make sure that the issue with this culvert is one that I could address and make sure that.
Okay. So let's stay focused, since you're up on that then, which is condition 8 then, for the unnamed tributary to Quail Creek, which is also the culvert, that the culvert is running under the road there.
Look at the new picture.
So if staff will flip back to the new picture. Let me just, though, read this first of all before we flip to that. The applicant shall submit a remedial action plan for review, and the plan shall address removal of sedimentation that has occurred in the unnamed tributary and a plan for ensuring protection of this tributary from future erosion and sedimentation impacts. So that's the condition as listed that the applicant is asking to be struck.
How about if I throw an alternative out there?
Please.
How about I go out with the representatives for the patent outs, take a look at the site in person, and then make some recommendations that way, if it's necessary. I don't know that it's necessary to submit a remedial plan. There may not be something necessary. I don't want to make a judgment call strictly off a photograph, and that's, in all my years of working, doing the permits, that's not how I work. I do site visits and then make an in-the-field determination. So I would rather go out there with the representatives of the patent nodes, determine what actually needs to be done, both on the upstream, downstream side, if anything needs to be done, and then I can send an email out that says, this is what I think. Would that be an acceptable alternative?
So staff, is there a way to incorporate that, if that's the direction?
Madam Chair, I think there is. We could even do that with the same timing that this existing condition has, where it's prior to issuance of the grading permit. Michael and Bill can prepare a condition that would have Fish and Game visit the site and make recommendations, and then those recommendations would need to be followed through on. And if that satisfies, and I wanted to skip back to 7 and make sure that your commission understands that there's a qualifier in the end of condition 7 that says that if the applicant is not going to plant the shrub, tree, and ground cover, then their engineer has to certify that the long-term erosion control will still occur. And I don't want you to lose sight of that last part of that condition. That qualifies everything there. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, so am I hearing agreement from other commissioners then on the condition 8, possibly staff might reword, or anything else for Mr. Hill while he's up here then on that?
I have nothing else for Mr. Hill, and I appreciate your offer. I am liking the idea of getting more specific about what needs to be done in terms of remedial action. I think also what concerns me, and I think concerns the applicant and the representative, is that the language says the plan shall address removal of sedimentation that has occurred in the unnamed tributary. I think what we really mean is the plan shall address a plan for ensuring protection of this tributary from future erosion and sedimentation impacts. In other words, I'm not really sure anybody is talking about removal of anything. We're talking about just making sure that culvert doesn't go back to looking the way it did a while ago, which it doesn't now, so hopefully it won't in the future. So my request for staff in terms of rewording this thing is not only to include some kind of a specific consultation with the Department of Fish and Game and Public Works and Planning and Building, but have to reshrub or recover or take things out. They just need to have agreed to do a plan, an erosion and sedimentation control plan, and the plan needs to just talk about long-term erosion control methods. If those methods do not include planting ground cover trees and shrubs, then their engineer just needs to say, yeah, what is there is going to work. That's all that language says in the way I'm reading it.
Okay, me too in that reading, but let's just cross-reference. Somewhere there is a reference to some number of hundreds of shrubs needing to be planted at, I think, 100-foot spacing or some kind of spacing along this road. Can staff direct us to where that is and where we may be seeing some possible expectation in the read that the shrubs would be required? Because also I'll mention as staff is looking for that section, when Commissioner White and I were on site, we did travel the extent of that access road, and we did see that vegetation has grown up on the side of the road where some things had been cleared and filled in. And I think I can speak for us both that we're sensitive to the applicant's suggestion that other vegetation has filled in. Now, I know there's a distinction between whether that's native vegetation and non-native vegetation, but it may actually be more damaging to have to tear up some of that existing vegetation and plant other things and haul water for it. So staff found the section that talks about that requirement?
Yeah, we discussed it on page 5-10 of the staff report.
Thank you.
That is a set number that's in the ordinance. The ordinance does allow, as we indicated, the condition, the project engineer to propose an alternative for long-range mitigation. And we anticipated that was actually going to be the course, because adhering strictly to that standard would result in quite a bit of planting. So that's why that is part of the condition.
Okay, and so let's see, reading that staff report then, we're seeing shrubs, one for every 100 square feet of slope and trees. So you're saying that can be read then to not be required. That's just a suggestion. What's the disconnect?
If they're going with an alternative plan, that plan would need to be to meet the same level or greater level of erosion control protection than this planting plan would.
Okay, and so you feel that that's feasible then, that the applicant's engineer then could come up with?
Yes, and then that would go through review with the grading permit, and the building division will be reviewing that, and the public works department would also be reviewing that.
Okay, so do I get the sense that other commissioners are comfortable with that then?
Yeah.
That would be decided then?
I would like to ask the applicant's agent if they have any concerns with that.
Jamie Kirk representing the Patnods. We thank you for the opportunity to come up to address that condition. Our concern with the condition is we've submitted several items from our engineer on this project, and his work has been requested to be peer-reviewed. So I appreciate listening to staff and the commission saying that if we have certification from our project engineer that existing conditions, or if we need to add a few more a few more modifications to the site to ensure the long-term erosion control. We're satisfied with that as long as our project engineer's work will be accepted.
Steph, want to comment on that one, how we address that concern?
Well, I mean, we don't have anything in front of us to meet these conditions at this time. It would be reviewed by the building division. We have someone who specializes in reviewing grading permits, and they'd want to make sure that we're meeting all of the best practices for erosion control. So it's hard to say, yeah, we're going to guarantee an approval. I don't know if anyone else wants to add anything to this.
Mr. Nolan, I was looking
to Mr. Marshall. Glenn, is there any amount of assistance that Public Works could provide us on that particular issue?
Certainly. Glenn Marshall with County Public Works. We do have licensed civil engineers on staff that are well-versed in erosion control, so there would be some internal peer review just through the Public Works Department with the grading permit that comes through and the erosion control plan.
Thanks, Glenn.
And so is there a way to maybe modify this condition to somehow suggest that somehow make a modification that we're leaning away from the plantings? Or
it's perfectly clear. They gotta have a erosion and sedimentation control plan that provides for long-term erosion control methods. And there's all kinds of things they can do or not do. And all they have to do is just have their engineer say, yeah, this is going to work. And by your own observations, whatever they're doing or not doing really right now is working. So I'm not really too worried about it. I don't think they're too worried about it. I think it's...
So I guess going backwards a little bit, as we were on site, I think many of you have read the article in the Tribune about the difficulties of getting this permit processed and that this is dragged on, and I certainly appreciated the applicant's difficulties as years have passed on this, and there's been some lots of issues that aren't clear, and I also appreciate that staff has had a hard time with this one, that it seems like somehow the applicant wasn't clear on some of the requirements. And so one of the things that came up when we were out on site the other day, and I think Commissioner White asked the applicant's agent, you know, what was mostly unclear, what a problem was here, and one of them was with the ag road sort of grading exemption issues, and that's come up in the staff report. And I see Mr. Eisensee here from the Ag Commissioner's office. So I'm wondering if Mr. Eisensee will just come up and speak a little to the issues of the agricultural road grading exemption and how this was sort of misconstrued here or confused, and how this sort of helped exacerbate the problem of this permit.
Sure, I'm Michael Eisensee with the Agriculture Department. I'm not entirely sure how it was misconstrued. My understanding from reading the staff report is that the applicant spoke with the Planning Department and possibly with Public Works Department and received the ordinance code sections that relate to agriculturally exempt grading, and specifically for road grading, and the standards for agricultural exempt roads are actually some of the clearest standards in there. It specifies the maximum width of roads, the maximum depth, the fact that they need to be revegetated, the maximum slopes that these roads can be located on, and clarifies that if you exceed any of those, you need to be in a review system, either a county grading permit, or you need to be working proactively with the Resource Conservation District to ensure that your road doesn't create the kind of problems that some of the photos you've seen existed on the site when the county first got involved with this road.
And so I guess I understand, we have in the staff report a list of the requirements then as you list for that. And so I guess I'd like to find out where the disconnect is. Do you have some sense of where the disconnect is, or how this sort of ag road exemption may be getting abused or create a problem? How we can eliminate a problem in the future?
Sure. I believe part of it is possibly even in the language itself. The fact that it's called an exemption, people think it's a free pass. And clearly, by what's in your staff report, it's not a free pass. There's very specific and defined criteria that need to be met. And by and large, most of our agricultural community is very aware of it and meets it just fine. And for the most part, it's used to maintain existing roads. So there's very little earth movement involved in those kinds of situations. I mean, it's clearing debris that's falling onto existing roads or small slides that have occurred. I think part of it is actually in the language that people hear exemption. They think, oh, well, I'm good to go. I'm agriculture. I'm going to be grazing some animals, whatever. And so I think that actually is where some of it exists. This certainly isn't the only site that this has come up for. And it seems in general it comes up when people think that this is a way to put in a road and then come back and get a permit for a residence or for other structures at the end of that road sometime in the future. And so it's maybe sold out in the community as an easier pathway. But that, I think, is maybe the applicant has found that's certainly not necessarily the case.
And so any suggestions for how this could have been smoother or some way? Huh?
Get a permit.
Certainly, to smooth things out, I mean, we generally, if someone talks to me, I recommend that they go and speak with the Resource Conservation District up front and bring them out to the site. They're very willing and eager to work with property owners, whether it's the Coastal Resource Conservation District in the coastal area or the Upper Salinas Los Tablas Resource Conservation District. They have specialists. They understand erosion control. They teach classes in erosion control. So, I mean, that's obviously the best way to go for agricultural roads, is to bring someone on who does this day in and day out and can make sure that you don't end up in a problem situation.
I've
got one question. You just mentioned that historically that this is primarily used just to do some cleaning of roads and cleaning up from erosion, that type of thing. Well, that doesn't require a grading permit. So
it's used extensively.
Well, growing up in the North County, almost every ranch I ever visited, there's an old rusty dozer out on the ranch, you know, with a tarp over it. So it was pretty commonplace. And in this particular situation, the concern I have is that we're caught up in a transitional period of what was done historically and what's allowed today. And like we're referring to these swells of topographic swells as creeks. And when you know, they were never a creek as defined the way I grew up thinking what a creek was, where you could go fishing or, you know, take your shoes off on a hot day and soak your feet in it. The only time there's ever any water there is when you have a large storm, you know, producing runoff from the hills. So it's not a defined banks and creek beds as I think most people would define it.
Sure, and I do think there is a bit of a new day in the last 10 or 20 years.
Absolutely.
And I think the ordinance recognizes that in the fact when it speaks proactively for these ag roads, that they need to address their erosion control up front. They need to have properly placed culverts. They need to have water bars. They need to be outsloped or insloped appropriately. It recognizes that all this water is going somewhere that your road generates, and you need to work with someone who's going to understand that. It's no longer the day that you just go out with a bulldozer and see how it works.
And clean it up later.
Right.
So, because that's historically, I believe, how it was done.
Yeah.
If we have a large storm before things can recede, then you go out and you clean it up.
Yeah, the ag exemption, or how we like to call it in our office, is qualified grading for agriculture. If it's for agriculture and you meet these, you're good to go. But it's not a free pass. There are standards. You need to think proactively about where this water's going and what it's carrying, or you're going to get in trouble, clearly.
Mr. Eisensee, well, following up on that, Commissioner White, I had a question about creeks too, but I think Mr. Eisensee isn't maybe the best person to address it. So maybe we can come back to that, because I think it also deserves a little more attention. But while Mr. Eisensee's up here, that also led to another issue here that we see is kind of that question of the agricultural exemption or qualified grading for agriculture, and what is kind of qualifies as agriculture and commercial agriculture versus sort of hobby farming. And so that's something that's come up here, and so I'm curious if you can elaborate a little more on that.
I think the elaboration in terms of production agriculture, the county general plan and the ag and open space element has an appendix. I can't remember off the top. I think it's Appendix J, called a production ag determination, and specifies, maybe unfortunately, that it's our office that does this, and it does it in terms of discretionary actions, primarily in terms of subdivision or lot line adjustments, general plan amendments, but it does state that we would do it for grading permits if the issue arises, and it does occasionally on these projects.
Excuse me, let me interject. So you would have to make that determination of whether it's production agriculture to allow the exemption for the grading. So that's the relevance here.
In part, yes. But for a grading permit, it doesn't really matter if you're doing this as a sidelight or as you're running 1,000 cows. If you're following the standards and it's for agriculture, whatever, the agriculture, you can use the qualification for agriculturally exempt grading. Where it does come into account is when people go and clear large areas or do a lot of grading, and there's problems, and there's no agriculture on site, and time passes and there still isn't, then it's like, well, wait a minute, what was this for? You cleared a hillside, you put in a road, but we don't have any animals on site, we don't have any vineyard that was talked about going in, and then you come in with a building permit, then it's like, well, that's not production agriculture, that's a road to your house, and so in some ways, it becomes very clear. And again, the ag exemption, the ordinance, tries to provide some leeway in that, but also give applicants some clarity that if you're going to use this road in the future to access a building, you're going to need a grading permit for it. So you need to consider that up front. So the production ag determination isn't really vital and isn't really not necessarily relevant, I don't think, for this project in any way, especially because it's clear that we have a project that's in with a building permit application. I mean, we got involved with this project as a grading permit, not as a question about being agriculturally exempt.
Right. So now it is. It just seems like that's among the bigger questions that we see in the bigger picture, if there's some incentive to claim agricultural production that's really very minimal as an in to get a road, and then like this, we
Department of Fish and Game staff to evaluate the need for removal of sedimentation that has occurred in the unnamed tributary and for the need for a plan to ensure protection of the unnamed tributary to Quail Water Creek from future erosion and sedimentation impacts.
I thought we were going to focus on the 18-foot easement.
Yeah, I thought we weren't going to worry about the unnamed tributary.
Yeah, we're trying not to get off the easement here to do any
right.
any cleanup, because it appears it's already been cleaned up when we were on site. So,
I thought we were going to say something like, prior to issuance of the grading permit, the applicant shall, in consultation with the Department of Fish and Game, Department of Planning, shall submit a remedial action plan, which shall address ensuring protection of this tributary from future erosion and sedimentation impact.
Well, how is that a remedial action plan? I mean, that's a...
Well,
that's not
we're talking
remedial.
About that culvert
We're eliminating
area.
The remedial part, so that's really not a remedial. That's
well,
a future.
No, we're talking about the... Well,
we're not talking about limiting any existing...
Remedial of the culvert area, which apparently is the same thing as the creek area. I mean,
that's right. The culvert's going under the road. It is...
Yeah.
Become, it's the de facto creek, although we missed the discussion on what's a creek exactly,
it's
because there are various definitions.
Prior to issuance of a grading permit, the applicant shall submit a remedial action plan in consultation with the California Department of Fish and Game. This plan shall ensure protection of this tributary from future erosion and sedimentation impacts. That's really what I want. I'm not
that's
really
not concerned. A remedial action plan. Maybe Mr. Hill can help us. He's raising his hand. But that's really a forward protection plan, right? I mean, remedial action seems to me to clean up what's already been done, and that's the part that we're taking
well,
out here. Am I mistaken? Isn't a remedial action cleaning up, remedying as something that's already happened?
I think it's already been cleaned up.
Well, that's the question.
What I don't want to do, I don't want to actually put, just given the testimony I heard from both you and Commissioner White and Mr. Hill and applicant and possibly staff, I do not want to have a condition that talks about removal of sedimentation from a creek, which we don't even know if it's a creek, and we don't know if the sedimentation is even there anymore, and the Department of Fish and Game says he doesn't really know what that's talking about. So what I don't want is to have a condition that is going to stop our applicants cold from going forward based on removal of sedimentation from a non-existent creek in a non-existent manner.
Right, so staff is going the way I want. So with that, really we're eliminating the remedial action plan. It's not a remedial action plan you're wanting. So we don't want to call this remedial. You're wanting to eliminate that.
No, remedial, if there's anything surrounding that culvert and that area that can be done in a remedial, that can fix whatever still needs to be done, as Mr. Hill suggested, I want that to be done, but I do not want it to specifically talk about removal of sedimentation. It's removal of sedimentation, not the remedial part.
I think we've got some alternative language.
Do you understand the difference?
Those comments, would you like to look
at the sedimentation part? But
yes, please.
Well, and I'm wondering, Madam Chair, John Dahl, I'm wondering if that's captured in the end of what we're going to have here, which is a plan that ensures protection of the tributary. I think that's the end goal, is that we don't want any additional sedimentation in the creek, and a plan that addresses that.
But yes, that's part of it, definitely.
Right.
But that's kind of covered up in number 7. What we also want is, and Mr. Hill began to start talking about it, he said, you know, I saw this thing a year ago, this is what needs to be done. And then we showed him a new picture, and we said, look, this is what's already, a lot of it's been done. And he said, and we said, do you think anything more needs to be done? And he says, well, I haven't seen it in a year.
Right.
I suggest I go out there and talk to them about what might need to still be done in terms of remedial.
Looks good now to me, I mean.
So, yes, protection of the, you know, but this, the new language in number 8 doesn't really talk about, I mean, it talks about, I guess, protection. It doesn't really talk about doing additional remedial work around this culvert.
Well, that's the difficulty here. That's the difficulty,
right?
Because we don't know what remedial work may need to be done, and we don't know whether permission from the property owner would be granted.
My understanding, if it's immediately within their easement, then they can do something.
But their easement is basically, if I'm not mistaken, the 18 feet of the road.
Well, you saw how
and
much
that might be there. That might be covered, Commissioner Christian, that might be covered with Condition 7, with the erosion control plan.
To me, 8 now just repeats 7, except it doesn't have the...
Anyway,
I'm not really... Except 7 doesn't have fish and game in it. So you can leave 8 in and fish and game go out and tell them what else they need to do. I'm fine. That's all I'm going to do.
So I think we'll get there that way. So.
Yeah, I'm okay with that then. Okay, I agree.
Okay. I'm comfortable with that. Gene?
Yeah, I do.
Okay, so we had that takes care of 7 and 8, which were items the applicant raised. We have the trees and monitoring came up, the number of years. We have 7 in the conditions as is, 7 years of monitoring, and I believe Mr. Null has recommended a lesser number of years.
Well, that was for your commission's consideration, Madam Chair, but given the number of trees that need to be planted, staff would still continue to recommend the 7.
Okay.
You could consider 5, but staff is recommending the 7.
7 remains the recommendation. Okay, so I...
The rest of the commission okay with 5?
I'd prefer to see the 7.
I'd prefer
if that's staff recommendation.
Yeah. If we don't have the votes, then it's a non-issue.
Okay, so we're going to leave that at 7 years for the monitoring for the oaks. Were there other changes then?
Madam Chair, there was the applicant's contention that they would not be able to find room on the subject property for replanting of the trees. And I don't know if Bill or Michael came up with some revised language for that, or if your commission even wishes to consider that.
Yes, that was right. Thank you for the notation that we would discuss adding the condition for the placement of the trees. Did you have some language for that, Mr. Conger and Mr. Robeson?
Yes, thank you. Bill Robeson, County Planning. Again, this goes back to condition number 20, to discuss the ability for the applicant to plant the blue oaks on the property that Commissioner Melskow brought up. It can be read, if it is determined by a qualified biologist that there is no suitable on-site replanting area for blue oaks, an off-site replanting plan shall be submitted for review and approval to the Department of Planning and Building.
Okay, and so is that a standard plan then for off-site? There's some kind of bank or something that...
They'll have to explain to us in their plan how they propose to accomplish this off-site mitigation.
Okay,
yeah.
And there are some stock sort of places of banking or...
Yeah. There's some of that.
Okay.
I think that wording sounds excellent.
Okay. Any other comments on that wording? Are you comfortable with that wording for off-site plan? Okay.
I think the applicant has one comment or question.
Sure.
Thank you, Jamie Kirk. One comment we might have to that question is have biologist / arborist so that we can work with an arborist on the replanting plan as well. I don't know if we'll have there will be an issue if we come up with a certified arborist preparing a plan. Because we are in consultation with a certified arborist right now looking at trying to locate appropriate locations.
Ms. Kirk, I'm sorry, was that a change to the wording or an addition? I didn't
catch
it.
Just a qualified biologist / arborist. I don't want to get caught up on having two people have to prepare the plan since we're already working with one.
So you would want to see that just reading biologist because you already have one.
Yeah, no. Biologist / arborist.
Oh, that's what you want to see. Okay,
yeah,
got it.
That's what he's got.
Okay.
And that sounds fine.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, are there any other comments then? Any other discussion or changes? I heard a motion was coming.
Yeah, I'm going to go ahead and make a motion. I'm going to move that the commission adopt the mitigated negative declaration in accordance with the applicable provisions of the California Environmental Quality Act, Public Resources Code, Section 21-SEC, and approve the conditional use permit DRC 2007-00101 based on the findings listed in Exhibit A and the conditions listed in Exhibit B, as modified, which included a modification of Condition 8 and a modification of Condition 20, as previously read into the record.
Okay. Is there a second for that motion?
I'll second it.
Okay. Motion made by Christensen, seconded by White. Clerk, you want to call the roll?
Commissioner Christensen?
Aye.
Commissioner White?
Yes.
Commissioner Melskow?
Yes.
Vice Chairperson Wyatt?
Yes.
Okay. Lunch. Okay, so with that is the last item on our agenda today. Before lunch, any other comments or items of business? Okay, does someone want to move that we take all items received into the record?
So moved.
Okay, so moved by Christensen, seconded by Melskow, and with that, I'll close this meeting. Thank you.
Right on.
Great.
Wow, that was good.
Good job.
Hey, we need you there getting this done by noon every time.
Yeah.